Hello and welcome to CanQueer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Luke Smith.
And I'm Sebastian.
And we're excited to be bringing you another special issue of CanQueer.
Is it special?
Well, I mean, it's special to me.
Is it like every week is a very special episode?
Always.
Like Clone High?
We are just really excited that you're taking the time to come and listen to us today.
So, well, I mean, yes, I will second that. Thank you, listener.
Absolutely. I mean, there's more than one of them.
What?
Brad, yeah.
There's more than just Bradley?
Yeah. Hi, Bradley. No, let's get right into it. You actually have an interview that you're sharing with this week's show. And
we've both interviewed him in the past, though.
Oh, he's phenomenal.
Yeah.
So we'll jump in first with Bruce MacArthur
and
some of the stuff going on in Canada. Then we'll jump to a song, we'll do the interview, we'll come back and we'll do a little bit of international stuff to round out the evening. You're probably thinking...
Or midday, it depends on where you're going out.
Yeah, well, you know.
We got an extra six stations, I believe. Is that what you told me?
Two or three of them,
Two or three of them? Okay.
We're in Liverpool, Nova Scotia now as well. Very excited about that.
Hello, Liverpool, Nova Scotia.
So, you're probably thinking, you know, Bruce MacArthur pleaded guilty. He got life in prison, 25 years before parole.
Yeah.
He's going to be 91 before he sees the light of day.
It's 25 years before a parole hearing that he may not win. So it could be longer.
So the question is, how is there even more news?
Mm.
Well, apparently, we've been following this story since not as long as we should have. The fact that gay men were missing in Toronto was something that we weren't aware of until near the end.
Mm-hmm. If we were located in Toronto and we're up on local news, we
probably would have noticed sooner, yeah.
Or if queer media in Canada
existed,
yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, we learned about the same time as everybody else, maybe a smidge before, given our contacts. But we knew that essentially people were going missing. But this has been going on for a long time.
Yeah.
The investigation, when Bruce MacArthur pleaded guilty, it tied back, I want to say 2010.
Gay men have been mysteriously been going missing for as long as there have been police records.
Yeah.
But... with regards to this specific case and the idea that there was a pattern emerging, that was sort of like the around 2012, 2013, where a pattern started to emerge. So, but I mean, it was suspected to be a pattern. There was no conclusive gathered evidence yet. And I specifically say conclusive gathered evidence because there was inconclusive ungathered evidence that had a strong hint that nobody was listening to.
We've been told by the Toronto Police Service that it was inconclusive or they had no clear idea. So in 2010, the first of the three men started to go missing.
Yeah.
So we're talking 2019 now, it was about 9 years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, these men are going missing and everyone's like, oh my gosh, what's going on? And then Project Houston was created to try and identify
If there's any link. Yeah.
All three of them were linked to Silver Fox 98, I think was the handle. Silver Fox 51. Sorry, I was quite close actually for a stab in the dark. But Silver Fox 51 was written down in Fizey's notebook. It was an account that had been chatting with Bruce MacArthur by Navaratnam. And then I think there was a third man as well that was linked by this.
Mm-hmm.
So they found that link to Bruce MacArthur. They hauled him in. They knew that there was a link to him and three of the victims in 2013.
Right. Even if there wasn't necessarily a hint. Because just, you know, let's play devil's advocate and say, you know, there was only a hint of a link. There was not necessarily a hint that he was the one making men go missing, but rather that they just knew that he was involved in some way, so that they had recourse to at least keep an eye on him.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, absolutely. So
if it wasn't him, he may know somebody who knows something. He may have been a potential victim or something. Like there's something about Bruce MacArthur that was fishy that they should have kept an eye on.
Yeah, there was a lot of things that were fishy about Bruce MacArthur in 2013 that they should have kept an eye on.
Right.
He had been arrested for trying to assault somebody with a crowbar who escaped.
Oh, okay.
That would have been on his record. And other investigators who were senior investigators at the time but not on this case are like, it's weird that they wouldn't have flagged that. That wouldn't have been a red flag.
Or, yeah.
You know, because you do a check before you talk to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if it's a roadside stop, you do a quick check.
Yeah.
You know, so that was weird. That's the first weird thing. Second of all, this investigation was launched in 2012. They'd been missing for about 2 years by that point.
Okay.
So it was Skandaraj, Navratnam, Abdul Basir Faizi, and Mahid Kayan. Within the year, so moving into 2013, they knew that Bruce MacArthur was linked to all three of them.
Right.
Deleted emails, written in the notebook, all that kind of thing. You have to bear in mind that Bruce MacArthur, when they raided his home, they found photos.
Trophies.
They found trophies. Yeah. When they went to his place of work where he kept all of his equipment, they found, you know, the bodies of the deceased in the planters.
Yeah.
So it begs the question, did they are clearly linked him. There's evidence, there's unsealed court documents from the Toronto Police itself saying, we want to follow him because we think he's linked.
Yeah.
So clearly they knew he was linked. And yet didn't take the step of investigating his home or investigating his where he keeps his tools. Or at least we don't know.
Yeah.
I don't believe he did. I think it would have emerged if he did. So people are peeved.
Yeah.
To say the very least.
Well, there's also clearly an internal problem going on, because the way they handled it in 2013 was, to put it kindly, subpar. But then what happened is the file eventually transferred hands to somebody else. And then when you look at the details about how the investigation resumed in 2017, and then the details of the 2017 investigation were above par, some really good detective work. And if the service is that inconsistent, where one person is basically just letting a serial killer walk free and the other person is doing like TV drama quality investigative work, what is the oversight like?
Well, the issue is that they had a bit of a split attention. You know, when we talked before about that sort of almost TV movie crime theory of like a tip comes in from Switzerland.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's a cabal of cannibals operating in Ontario.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, and some Swiss guy who actually caught a cannibal in Switzerland saw a similar pattern, was like, hey, guys, we think there's somebody in Toronto.
Yeah.
And it was actually a man called Brunton. Alex Brunton was suspected in the disappearance of Navratnam. They launched Project Houston because of this Swiss tip that linked them all together, because thankfully the Swiss guy did a bit of work on their behalf. And they were really closely following Alex Brunton. There was most of the documents that got unsealed a couple of weeks ago were all about investigation and following this Alex Brunton guy. Alex Brunton didn't kill these men. We knew it was Bruce MacArthur.
Right.
He did plead guilty to child pornography charges.
Okay.
He was arrested by the FBI because he was chatting also to some underage people in the States.
Right.
So they were looking at him. TPS was looking at him. But was their eye off the ball? Were they so focused on that cannibal lead that even though they had linked three of the murders to Bruce MacArthur, they didn't take that investigation any further? Were they distracted? Were they working to just one theory instead of looking at other options and other scenarios?
Yeah, they probably should have had at least one investigator still on this. And something that's like, it's not necessarily well known, is that investigators, it's not like in the TV dramas where they work one case until it's complete. Usually they work a dozen cases all at once, because sometimes evidence comes in so slowly that they can only do 2 hours of work on one case in a week. But still, having one person monitor it part-time.
But that was no one's job.
Yeah, nobody did that.
Yeah, because the Toronto Police Service, unlike most modern metropolitans in Canada, did not have a missing persons unit.
Oh, really?
They launched it just last year. It is absolutely ridiculous that this is the case. There is a review being done, an independent review that is being done by a former judge. The Toronto Police Service reached out to the judge, she's now leading up this investigation. I believe it's Epstein, Judge Epstein. Gloria Epstein. She's a former Superior Court judge for Ontario.
Okay.
I've actually spoken to somebody who's on that panel.
Right.
In an off-the-record conversation. And they're really hoping that the Toronto Police Service will keep that investigation, because the independent panel led by Gloria Epstein is actually the remit of the panel, and the sort of mandate of it was designed in close collaboration with community members.
Right. Okay.
So normally these kinds of things are passed off to third party police investigators, but this is one of the very rare occasions where the police have actually handed a lot of that decision making into what is covered to the community themselves that are affected. Now, it's already underway. There's the argument that this TPS one is going to be a fraction of the cost of a public inquiry, and would presumably be quicker as well. Now, Gloria Epstein, Judge Epstein, has asked the Toronto Police Services, now that Bruce MacArthur pled guilty, to actually include the Bruce MacArthur investigation into her review of missing persons cases.
Right.
Okay. Because although this independent commission was set up, they were clearly told, do not investigate or review the Bruce MacArthur missing persons case, which is literally the thing that caused the panel to begin with.
Well, when things are still in court, it's complicated to deal with things. There's a lot of instances where things are delayed until they're not in court anymore.
Absolutely.
For various reasons that make good sense.
Yeah.
Now,
everyone has the right to a free trial.
Exactly. So something that's coming out of this, like for years, the accusation was that the Toronto police had an institutional racism or institutional homophobia problem. And that may or may not be the case, but we can definitely say that they definitely have a structural problem and a competency problem that... maybe that structural...
when it comes to engaging with the community.
Yeah, for sure. I'm sort of on the fence. I don't know what to think about whether or not they do have an institutional racism or institutional homophobia problem. But they do definitely have just an institutional problem that they need to reformat how they function. I still hold my judgment otherwise. I could be convinced either way. I'm kind of agnostic at this point because there's evidence on both sides of the argument. But they definitely... they dropped the ball in terms of, like, they're just poorly organized as an institution.
Toronto Police, in responding to Gloria Epstein, is like, you know what, before we do, they've actually reached out to the Ontario Attorney General, Caroline Mulroney, and essentially said, are you investigating this?
Right.
Is there currently a public inquiry in the works, which means that...
into Toronto Police.
Into the Toronto Police handling of the Bruce MacArthur case.
Right, right, right.
So there's been a lot of demand for a public inquiry.
Yeah.
And incidents like this, where they linked into three...
yeah.
Did nothing... it would appear did not do enough investigatory work, and then five more men died.
Yeah.
Like, that's a real serious breach of confidence at the very least.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So the Ontario Attorney General, I believe... has not indicated that there is a public inquiry at the provincial level investigating it at the moment.
Right.
But this is all new. We're still covering it. We don't know exactly what's happening in those next steps.
Yeah.
But we do know that Toronto Police Service has an inquiry into it. There is still the professional conduct charge against one of the investigators.
Oh, yes.
One of the sergeants from 2013. Now that we're seeing these kinds of...
do you know the nature of that... What was the professional misconduct?
Because
I've read multiple times that there's charges about this, but I'm yet to read something where they say
the exact details.
What the misconduct was
thin on the ground, but we know it was from 2013.
Okay,
we know it was linked to when Bruce MacArthur was brought in for an interview.
Okay,
we now know that in 2013 he was also linked to three of the murders.
Right,
so
it's probably some kind of a negligence thing.
Possibly. We don't know yet.
We don't know.
That internal trial actually got pushed. So that hasn't happened yet. But we'll be keeping an eye on that as well. But there's a lot of things moving, a lot of moving pieces with this. And who knew? Who knows? We know that confidence in the Toronto Police has certainly been shaken to the ground.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Because even if, in a way, massive institutional organizational problems is kind of worse than a homophobia problem or a racism problem. Because if it's homophobia or racism, you just identify who the homophobes and the racists are and you fire them. Or you relegate them off to desk work where they can't actually have any impact on anything. Reformatting an institution to actually function properly is a bigger, harder problem in many ways. So, I mean, it's... I don't know. I have high hopes for the Toronto Police, and I, you know, I have high hopes for their future, mostly because it's the community that wins first.
Yeah.
When they get their act together. But I really do hope they get their act together.
Well, I wanted to give a quick update on what I'd said earlier. Mulroney, the Attorney General, said that there is no current intention to run a public inquiry, but rather noted that they hope the scope of the Toronto Police Missing Persons Cases Review done by Ontario Court of Appeal Justice Gloria Epstein will be, and the panel she's working with, will be as broad as possible. The Toronto Police Services Chair of the Board has indicated that although the decision hasn't been made yet, they would consider the request by Epstein to cover that.
Yeah.
So we now have to sit and wait. Hopefully TPS will give Epstein the authority to investigate that case,
right,
which is really the one that a lot of people have a lot of questions about. And then it'll be a while before we find out more. Probably next spring, I think, is when the report will come out.
These things are slow. We'll probably get updates throughout the year, though. We'll get bits and pieces. But yeah.
Let's cut to our first song. This is Any Other Way by Jackie Shane. Jackie Shane is truly monumental.
Yes.
Had limited number of hits. I think Any Other Way is probably her biggest hit.
Yeah.
But was in the scene in Toronto, one of the first recorded instances of a trans person with a public persona. That was really out there.
Right, yeah.
Vanished off the face of the earth, was then like rediscovered about 5 years ago. Got a Grammy nomination this past few months ago, but actually passed away in the past week or so.
Okay.
So it is very unfortunate that this Canadian icon, Jackie Shane, has passed, but this is the track Any Other Way, and we'll be back just after this.
And you say that you're my friend, but I don't know why you're here. She wants to know how I feel. Tell her that I'm happy. Tell her that I'm gay. Tell her I wouldn't have it any other way. Since we've been apart, and when I pass, I hear them whisper, there he goes with a broken heart. But when you see my baby, he is what you say. Tell her I wouldn't have it any other way. That's all I got to say, my friend. Now we'd better say goodbye. I think you'd better go right now, or you might see me cry. But when you see my baby, this is what you say. Tell her I wouldn't have it any other way.
Just Hello and welcome back to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is still Luke Smith.
And I am Sebastian.
And we're going to jump to the interview that we did. There were some other stories in Canada. There's a big mural at Church in Wellesley that's going to get knocked down because of development.
Oh, man.
Which is hardly surprising. Development in Toronto causes local landmark change.
Yeah.
Not a big story. But it does raise the question of how the character of certain areas, including the gay village, is altered by development. We don't have time to get into that now because we're jumping into the interview that you did with Gary Lacasse.
With Gary Lacasse.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Please introduce yourself for the audience.
Well, I'm Gary Lacasse. I'm the executive director of the Canadian AIDS Society here in Ottawa.
Mm-hmm. And it's a national organization?
Yes, we're the national advocacy group for the HIV community actions in Canada.
Do you do education, or is that more of a Health Canada thing?
That's more of a KD and Health Canada.
Okay.
While the Public Health Agency of Canada.
Okay.
We are more on the advocacy to ensure that financing, programming, and all that is sustainable in Canada for HIV, and that we're eradicating this dreadful disease that's still out there.
Mm-hmm.
That's increasing in number of transmissions year over year for the last 2 years, which is inexplicable, but I have my thoughts.
Yeah. it's not ideal, yeah.
No, it's not ideal because I mean like a 17% increase last year.
Mm-hmm.
And that's scary. To see that where in England the rates are going down like drastically and they're winning this fight and we're such a rich country. And I find that we're being led bureaucratically instead of politically, which is, this is the detriment that we're living in with two people in PIAC probably designing this cloud that's going to be our HIV initiatives in Canada, which are not working and they're not admitting. So
tell me about this project that's going on right now.
Well, this project is the first of, so it's really great to see. What's happening is that Hazel Meyer, who is an artist who is now based in Los Angeles.
Okay.
She must be good if she's in Los Angeles now, right?
Presumably.
Yeah. She saw the interview we did for CBC concerning the cuts in the HIV sector from the Liberal government under Justin Trudeau.
Right.
Saw the picture of me in front of the AIDS quilts that we had in our locker at the time,
right,
which are in these hockey bags.
Okay.
And she had been approached a couple of months prior to that from a curator in Windsor about an exposition that an exhibit they were going to do about hockey.
Okay.
So the stars aligned themselves. She saw me in front of the hockey bags. She's a performance artist.
Right.
And she says, this could be the exhibit that we have. Part of the exhibit that we have, the hockey bags with the quilts, it's centered on gender identity and all that, so it's great and seeped in hockey and that. So finally Hazel called us. We through one of our employees here at the time facilitated Hazel to and I to discuss and come to a conclusion that this would be a great idea. So with the curator, Jacqueline Malosh of the Art Gallery of Windsor, we shipped the 22 bags of quilts to them. The quilts are in the bags.
Right.
And it's part of an exhibit that's going to go around Canada in the next 2 years or 3 years.
But starting in Windsor.
It started in Windsor. Imagine of all places where I just came back from.
It's got to start somewhere.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's I was inspired because, you know, like you go through low valleys and highs during your work life.
You know?
And I was a bit in a rut in January, and I'll be truly admit it. And so when we started this whole process, I was going to Windsor, was saying, okay, how much visibility are we going to get in a hockey exhibition with Canadian AIDS quilts representing over 1,000 people who've died in this epidemic in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
How is it going to integrate me not being artsy-fartsy at all?
Mm-hmm.
So I landed, well, I didn't land because it was I was left on the day of the ice storm.
Okay.
So it took me 16 hours.
Which one? Planes, been trains, like seven so far.
Amazing. loved it. So I arrived in Windsor, and lo and behold, I get off the train because I had to transfer to a train in Toronto to get there.
Right.
The artist was there, Hazel Meyer. So Hazel and I went for a drink at this lovely bar in Windsor that I recommend, the Loose Goose.
Okay.
And she inspired me. She really got my mojo going.
Right.
And the next day, I saw the exhibit, and we had our first press conference the next morning. And it really brought me back down to the roots of where what we're doing here, mm-hmm. and reignited what I want to do.
Right.
So I came back here from this exhibit, and my staff and I are rocking since, because it's like, this is what we, this is where we need to go, this is what we need to do, and they're like, hold on. So so what was interesting was to see the engagement of Jacqueline Mellush of the Art Gallery,
right,
and how they saw the eight quilts as being a textile representation of the AIDS movement.
Right.
And that's what it is. It's really, you know, like when we talk about the AIDS quilts, you see a section here in our conference room, which we call our living room because we store the quilts here now. And, you know, they all started because funeral directors would not bury the people dying of AIDS
right.
back in the day.
Right.
So the size of a grave plot.
Is that how the size was chosen?
Yes. So, seeped out of that, as you can see, this one represents somebody who died in 1996.
Right, yeah.
Just when antiretroviral treatment started, that prolonged the life of people.
Mm-hmm.
From there, we are the people living with HIV have the same life expectancy almost as people who do not have HIV.
Right.
And this is his family and his friends that did this panel. That talked about his love of liquor, cigarettes.
Yeah.
He liked the Maurier.
And you have an orchid in the upper right-hand corner.
Yes, and he was a painter too. So, I mean, these are seeped in so much knowledge of who they were. How can we go aside from it?
Mm-hmm.
But these are all put together in 12-foot by 12-foot panels.
Right.
So they're big.
Right, yes.
So... So what happened and they celebrate the lives of over 1,000 people, as I said here, the Canada quilts to have.
Right.
The American quilts, all put together,
mm-hmm.
are the size of, they fit in the mall in Washington, so you can imagine.
Yeah, I was going to ask, do you remember when they first put the exhibit on, where they had all the quilts put together?
That was the last time was at the previous, the AIDS conference in Washington was in 2012.
Okay.
That was prior to that, because in 2012 they were renovating the mall.
Okay.
So I don't remember the exact date, but ours fill up.
The first time was in the 80s though, wasn't it? The first time they did a quilt exhibition?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was the American quilt. Ours, they fill up a hockey arena.
Okay.
So that's pretty big, even though it's impressive to
right.
see the panels, and it's an interesting concept, and to see the 22 bags together, this was a grant from Molson's on top of that.
Oh really?
Yeah. So Molson's gave us a little grant to get these hockey bags done.
Okay.
So we contacted Molson; they never returned our calls.
All right.
Sponsorship 101 never works anymore, and it's really dried up. But anyways, so we put they're all blue bags, and they're all put out there, and to see that collection there is really awe-inspiring,
mm-hmm.
and to see the interest that the press had,
mm-hmm.
and to see the interest that I was looking during the opening. At a family, a mother and father and two children walking through the exhibit. And we're talking about an exhibit that's seeped into our queer life.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, it's about gender, it's about diversity.
The quilt has like a 30-year history in the community.
Yeah, but it's not only the quilt, you know. Yeah. Like we have Jacques Plante's first hockey mask that he had.
That was there?
Yeah, that was there.
That's my dad's cousin.
We have,
Yeah, the Plante family, they're all related. All the Plantes are related to each other.
Oh, my God. And we had two pieces of work of Mohawk.
Okay.
That was there. There was Liz Peel. Pete, that was there with her quilts. She makes textile panels with used hockey stuff that she finds in the dumpsters at the arenas.
Okay.
So it was all cutting edge stuff.
Right, yeah.
It was a Quebec artist with his hockey cards, 2,500 of them put together to represent the 1940s escapism and art and all that.
Okay.
If I'm saying it right. So it was really a diverse mix of people that were there, and all the artists were there. So the quilts were part of it, but to see this family bring their two kids to a hockey exhibit, not knowing maybe what exactly it was about, but staying.
Yeah.
And going through, and like they stopped in front of the quilts and looked at the 22 bags in the middle of the room, and they were like, reading, and they were explaining to their children.
Were any of the quilts out so that you could see them?
No.
No, not even pictures so that you could see what it was about?
No, we invite the people to go to the quilt site.
Okay.
So it was really awe-inspiring to see the parents discuss with their children, who were about 9 or 10 years old, what these quilts were.
Right.
So I think it's going to be an amazing awareness tool. And also to also celebrate the lives of the people who are in those bags.
Yes.
Because, you know, like, we have panels all over behind you. We have
individual
panel sections that still have to be sewed together. And we have some sections
on the sides, too. Yeah.
And we have panels that we have complete quilts that can't go around the country anymore because they're damaged so much.
They're delicate and old.
They're very delicate, a lot of moisture and all that. So that was great. But what really was touching was when we had the gallery opening, which was great. Press was there also after a press conference, but we had a panel discussion the next day with the AIDS Committee of Windsor, who was there, Michael Brennan, the ED, and Hazel Meyer was there, the artist, and I was there, and we unfolded a section.
Okay.
But the way Hazel came up with the idea, because she's a performance art
girl, yes,
is that everybody that was there for the panel discussion touched the quilt.
Okay.
Lifted it off the ground. We were enough people to lift and have people around the quilt completely.
Mm-hmm.
And we turned the quilt as I was explaining the provenance and why we have the quilts.
Right.
So it was a moment that I will replicate as I go on with this fight.
Okay.
It's an amazing thing. So you have a 12-foot by 12-foot quilt that people are turning between them. It was almost religious in itself. It was really great.
Using art for politics has a bit of a bumpy history.
Yeah.
Sometimes it misfires.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it conveys the wrong idea.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's deeply successful.
Yes, it is. And I have to nod to the employee I had last year, Ryan Conrad.
Mm-hmm.
He's a HIV activist. He's a young lad. He's about 20, 35 years old. Mm-hmm. For me, that's young.
Right.
And he is friends with Hazel.
Okay.
So that's how this all came to be glued together. And he's also a professor at Concordia. And he's a huge activist. He's really all about how we're going to keep the history, and he's a history AIDS activist and everything. He was working at Carleton and so on and so forth. So with Alex, and it was a great network there, and it's to see where we're going with this. And we were trying to see how, because we've tried everything in HIV.
Yeah.
So the cultural relevance of going out with cultural aspects of art to push prevention and to reduce stigma.
Yes.
So that's where we were edging to go to now.
Yeah.
And that's where I think we're going to land as an organization as we go forward. We're doing the National Testing Day. We're doing tons of things that are really relevant at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's some things that are through art and cultural relevance that will be really interesting to see.
So some time ago, I had a conversation with Jay Kornstra about this. about the delicate balancing point between trying to tell people that you really don't want to have HIV versus respecting those who have it. Like, you don't want to make monsters out of people who have it, but you also want to remind people that it's better to not be HIV positive if possible. And I asked him, how do you strike that balance as an activist? And his answer was, the only thing you can do is emphasize agency, that you have the agency to protect yourself, and things happen. You know, diseases are not known for respecting your decisions. Sometimes you do everything right and you contract it anyway. And when you do, if you do, you have the agency to protect others and to continue protecting yourself through good lifestyle choices. And it's, I don't think there's such a thing as a right answer, because it's a hard situation. But I liked that answer because the idea of empowering individuals and empowering communities, I think that's never the wrong answer. You know, sometimes there's other better answers, but empowering yourself, I think, is always a good answer. And I really respected that answer.
I truly believe that answer is great. I believe in the same path,
mm-hmm.
as towards empowerment,
mm-hmm.
awareness.
Mm-hmm.
A
lot of the modern tools are all about empowerment as well, like the at-home testing kits and PrEP and a lot of them.
We don't have that here yet. The at-home testing kits are not available in Canada. So, you know, like...
You can get interesting things on the internet if you know where to look.
I know, but the whole thing is that our government does not have any testing strategy here in place federally. So, you know, like, what we really need,
mm-hmm.
as we go forward here, to acknowledge the quilts as, you know, like, we also have to not do a nod back at the past.
Yes.
To advance correctly. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the issue is that we have to be able to seep our prevention in, yes, in empowerment is the singular way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But we can't continue doing prevention the same way that the government wants us to do it today.
How are they expecting you to do it?
They're
handing out pamphlets and that's it?
They just gave, and I have nothing. I'm going to pay for this like you wouldn't believe. But anyways, I'm going to go out on it. I don't care.
Uh-huh.
You cannot continue preaching to gay prides in Canada. You can't.
Okay.
They've been over-preached to. Mm-hmm. They've been over-stigmatized.
Yeah.
They've been over, not only stigmatized, but they've been really energized.
Right, yeah.
And the issue is that if we have gotten to that point where we've overstimulated a certain demographic,
right,
and the rates are still increasing,
you're talking to the wrong people.
Yeah,
yeah. You're.
But the new funds that mm-hmm. were given just a couple of months ago are specifically to go into the prides again.
Okay.
So we had asked the government with our request for funding to go rurally and outside the urban centers that right. have gay villages.
Right.
That's yeah. where we think
mm-hmm.
the infection rates are out of proportion. But you have to do it in a culturally relevant, depending on the geographic areas also. So
I've run into that with people as well, where they're talking about doing certain kinds of activism and they want to bring all of Canada in, to which I say, well, if you want to bring all of Canada in, you need to realize that rural settings have a different way of communicating than urban settings. Things like, most of the people I know from who are raised in more sort of country villages in Canada, queer is still a word of hate. Like in the cities, that's an academic word, or it's a word of inclusion, or if it's a generic word to include all of the LGBT possible identities. But in the countryside, it's just as bad as the F-bomb as far as they're concerned.
Totally.
So learning how to communicate to multiple places at the same time, adjusting to your audience, being aware of the context, noting the differences in culture, these are very important things that not everyone's really paying attention to.
Well, we have for years.
Well, you have
our
to.
Our network is community-based organizations across right. Canada.
And you're going to have some yes. local grassroots organization calling you up saying, this isn't working for us.
Adapted to us.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. We used to be able to do that, but we don't have the financing to do it anymore.
Okay.
So if somebody called us from Saskatoon who were dealing with off-reserve indigenous people.
Right.
Okay. That was because that's the most underserved population in Canada.
Yeah.
Is off-reserve indigenous people.
And the HIV rates are not nice either.
No. Yeah. No. Because, you know, like we're talking about the prairies where the indigenous population are the most in, as if I could say it this way, in mouvance. They're moving along.
Yes. Around. Okay.
So, and
nomadic,
then you say,
to a certain degree, I guess. Pardon? A little bit nomadic.
Yes.
Yeah.
They are, because that's what we've heard.
Right.
I'm going to Regina next week to Fort Capel.
Okay.
For a week of visioning with the chiefs.
Right.
And the HIV organizations there. I can't wait for this. This is going to be like, I'm hesitant about the pipe smoking because I just quit smoking. But anyways, but where if we could step back is that, so if I get a call from Saskatoon saying I need more relevant material for where I am,
yeah.
Then I get a call from the Kootenays in BC that say I need something for here.
Yeah.
And then the organization in Montreal says, well, I know everything and I don't need anything. That, you know, so you have a discord.
Yeah.
And so that's where it is. But I'd like to get back on Jay Koonstra's thing.
Yeah.
Because I got called out this last summer because I did an interview with, I think it was CBC. And we were talking about rates and I was misquoted because my whole sentence was leading up to what I, and it was, what they took out of it was part of what I was saying.
Okay.
So I was saying that the stigmatization and the criminalization and everything else that goes into the way that people cannot take empowerment,
yeah,
really increases. And we have to understand that also it's people who have HIV that are transmitting HIV.
Mm-hmm.
So they only took that last sentence out there.
Oh, okay.
So I got like called out like crazy. It was like, you shouldn't be saying that. You're stigmatizing people who are living with HIV.
Oh.
So again, talking to what we were having as a discussion before, yeah, the political correctness of it.
But on the other hand, like, because I read some of this data every mm-hmm. so often. I just update myself, see what the latest yeah. numbers are. Something like half of the new cases, people contracted from people who don't know they have it yet.
Yeah. But the other half
mm-hmm.
are contracting from people who know they have it.
Mm-hmm.
Our movement is seeped in history.
Yes. Yeah.
And that history has to come back out to really see the relevance of what we're doing. And I think it could lead the path where we have to go. That's what I really think.
That's actually a pretty good note to end on. Yes, thank you very much for meeting with me.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Said we never go far, baby, now look where we are. Just gotta keep on moving on. I feel the way I feel. gonna keep on moving on.
Hello and welcome back. That was Boomtang Moving On.
Yes.
You chose Boomtang Moving On. How come?
Because I was listening to mixed music and then I was like, oh yeah, they're Canadian. And then I remembered, oh yeah, they were in the gay scene. And then, because you often complain that whenever we try to track down artists who are both queer and Canadian.
They're so dirgy.
Yeah, but the early 2000s had this explosion in like joyous music out of the Canadian queer scene. And if you want to listen to joyous music from the Canadian queer scene, you're very limited.
Yeah, gay men make very depressing music.
But they don't, because you also get, like, one of my favorites is Sylvester, who in the late 70s made really good disco, and it was fun and joyous and stuff like that. And
Elton John has done some pretty good stuff as
well. Elton John looks, oh man, anything with the word Saturday in it that Elton John sang, because he's Saturday shows up in several of his songs.
Saturday,
it's going to be good, it's going to be fun. So,
absolutely.
But yeah, no,
Now... One of the things I wanted to mention is I'm not entirely convinced by the I'm using air quotes, initiatives to help fight LGBT criminalization across 71 countries that was announced.
Yeah.
Actually, GLAAD, which is the...
Gays and Lesbians.
Against Defamation.
Yeah.
League against... I don't know.
I don't remember the second A as well.
There's always too many A's in there. Acting Against Defamation.
Association Against Defamation?
I don't know. There's something against defamation.
Yeah.
But they've actually tweeted out, and I thought this was great. We'd believe that the Trump administration is working to protect LGBTQ people around the world if they hadn't been attacking LGBT people in the US over 90 times since taking office. So there are so many Republican-backed bills at the Senate level, at the state level, that have really chipped away at various rights. And there's all sorts of things that they're doing through various federal agencies as well. Now, but then suddenly somebody tells Trump that Iran, enemy number one, minus the press.
Well, China's enemy number one.
Okay, enemy number top five somewhere.
Yeah, that's fine.
you know, is throwing gay men off of buildings, which we've known has been going on for years.
Apparently, and when Trump found out, he's like, really? That happens? And people were just like, yes.
And it wasn't just Trump. It was typically it's ISIS that did this. They had when they were controlling large parts of Syria, they were very prone to doing that. You know, and we've reported on it extensively. But so the ambassador to Germany is leading this initiative, flying activists from all over the world to Germany. Apparently, Trump didn't really know. Mike Pence has obviously said he supports it, but I think that's because it's now government policy, and it'd be awkward for him to say no. And I don't know. I'm not. This is good. I say through strained teeth, like, you know.
I am optimistic because I choose to be, because I would like to believe that this is serious and something will come out of it. I'm also skeptical.
But
actually, I did hear good news out of Iran that's related to this, and that is a riot broke out last week, and you'd think, how is a riot good news? So in Iran, most of the population of Iran is actually very liberal and progressive. It's just that the conservatives, ultra crazy conservatives, that even conservatives are like, we're not with those guys. Like, those are the people in power. So the good news about the riot was that it was people in Tehran, like the most progressive city in Iran, trying to stop the morality police from attacking a woman who wasn't wearing a hijab. So people in Iran are starting to fight back against the organizations that are doing this sort of thing. Now, this has more to do with sexism, misogyny, and the oppression of women, but this is a good sign. If people are starting to reject the morality police in Iran, who are self-organized and are not sanctioned by the state, but the state also doesn't do anything about them.
You have to remember that in Iran, the state is really a puppet to the theocracy. You know, the theocracy so the religious leadership in Iran is really, they're the ones in charge.
Yeah.
They choose who the president is. You know, and so the morality police certainly follow the real power.
But individual people within Iran are starting to get tired of it. So this is a sign, possibly, hopefully a good sign and not a bad bloody revolution sign, but a good sign.
Well, we'll have to cross our fingers. Now, we just maybe have time to cover the biggest story that we didn't get to, which I think is...
Which one's that one?
It's the Jesse Smollett one.
Oh, yes.
You know, all our listeners know what's been going on.
Hopefully,
that the Empire actor was charged with a felony for filing a false police report. He is accused of faking his alleged hate crime.
Yep.
The evidence that has emerged is overwhelmingly in favor of, he faked it.
Yeah.
And the impact of that has been quite extreme on both sides of the political spectrum.
Yeah.
So I know you've been following this quite closely.
Oh, yes. Not only that, but actually I've been following some of the discussions of it on Reddit, which is actually very strongly left-leaning, generally speaking. And there are discussions in the media, in social media spaces, about what the impact is going to be. And there's a lot of people who initially were worried that this is going to increase the number of hate crimes in the United States. But actually, more people, it turns out, are worried that this is going to change how organizations and institutions, especially the police, react to accusations of hate crimes. That the number of hoaxed hate crimes is increasing in the states, as well as actual hate crimes. So the number of hate crimes in the states has been increasing over time, but the number of cases like Jesse, like one of the problems with Jesse Smollett was that the men who attacked him, he paid them, and he paid them with a check, which is...
I'm surprised they didn't ask for a receipt.
It was bad crime, but cases like that where it's cut clear, like good evidence that it was hoaxed, there's been about 500 cases like that across the states over the past couple of years. And there's this huge worry about what this is going to do in terms of the state stepping in and actually helping people who are victims of real hate crimes. And that this is basically bad for everyone because, people who are victims of hate crimes might be less willing to step forward because they will be inclined to assume the police won't believe them. Or if they do, the police might start off from a position of suspecting that it's a hoax. Now, the way that I see it, like the way that a good officer would look at it, is if somebody reports a hate crime, one of two things happen. You know, it really did happen, at which point you need to investigate it, find evidence, and find the people who did it. Or it's hoaxed, at which point you need to investigate it, find evidence, and bring in the hoaxer. Yeah. Either way, you need to take every case seriously. That's in an ideal world with good, mature, well-trained police officers who are just interested in justice. That is not universal in the United States, especially when you get to small towns that actually have sheriffs instead of police commissioners. You get bad, bad investigating happening.
Well, we do know that, in a lot of these small towns, you know, police do the best they can. And it reminds me of that case out in... where the straight pride flag being raised in the small town near Moncton. Everyone there thought that they were doing the right thing. Had no idea. You know what I mean? It's, you're not, if you're not exposed to these sort of realities, it's hard to really grasp them.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, we can't go really any further into this because we've run out of time.
And it's a big story. And it's not a Canadian story, but it is a big story.
It's a big, meaty story. Unfortunately, we will keep an eye on it. And if things develop, we'll continue to cover it. We're playing out with Superfruit's The Promise, starring Adam Ritten. We'll be back next week. I've been Luke Smith.
And I've been Sebastian. And thanks for listening. Be there, but when you're in doubt.
When your day is through, and so is your temper, you know what to do. I'm gonna always be there. Sometimes if I shout, it's not what's intended. These words just come out with no cry to bear. I'm sorry, but I'm just thinking of the right words to say. I know they don't sound the way I planned them to be. But if you wait around a while, I'll make you fall for me.
Just thinking of the right words.